Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the 10-Minute U.S. History Podcast. Just a heads up, this is part two, so if you haven't heard part one yet, I would recommend going back and listening to that. For time purposes, I will just do a quick recap of what happened last time. When we left the readjusters, they had just put together their winning coalition of pro-debt repudiation conservatives, freed people, and white liberals, and began winning elections throughout Virginia. Now, throughout Mahone's time as de facto party ruler, he had to constantly create pragmatic solutions to prevent various factions from defecting to the opposite side. In essence, it took a lot of compromise and strength to keep this political party one fairly solid and fairly unified political party. Mahone had two primary ways of dealing with his simultaneously powerful and powerless position atop this network of competing factions. The first was a complex spoils system that was already in place for centuries in Virginia, but which was brought to a whole new level when the officially independent Mahones sided with Republicans in the United States Congress in 1881. This gave Republicans control of Congress, and in exchange, Mahone received access to the federal spoils program to reward party supporters and deter detractors. His second strategy was through fairly straightforward compromises. In order to remain in power, Mahone realized that the party could not create dogmatic policies the way traditional parties with broader bases had in the past. As a result, Mahone found himself constantly negotiating deals between combative interests to secure a voting majority. Most of the readjuster's most substantial achievements come from this time period, such as the prohibition of the whipping post, the highest percentage of black representation in the Virginian Assembly until modern times, and the recreation of the public education program based on separate, but actually fairly equal policies. While most schools remained segregated, both the black and white school systems paid the teachers the same and had equal public funding. I do say fairly equal instead of just equal, however, because there was significant controversy during this time period about whether or not African American teachers could teach in white schools, and there was controversy going the other way because a lot of white teachers were being preferred over African-American teachers even in the black school system. Now, this was not the case everywhere, and some cities' black communities actually stood up against this and got this overturned. For all their successes, the height of the readjuster power was not all gold. As the readjuster movement became increasingly liberal, large segments of the pro-repudiation conservatives began to exit the coalition en masse. The most symbolic of these was the Parson Macy exit. Macy had been with the readjuster movement prior to Mahone and felt crossed when Mahone's ascendancy came at the cost of his own personal influence. The growing liberalism within Mahone's readjuster movement proved too much for the conservative at heart, and personal animosity between Macy and Mahone left compromise impossible. Unfortunately for the readjusters, Macy's exit prompted the beginning of the end for the coalition. By the 1883 election, the former funders, who were now just advertising themselves as the Democrat Party, had decided upon a four-front strategy to bring down the readjuster revolt. The first was to paint Mahone as a corrupt political boss, the perfect symbol for everything negative about the Gilded Age political arena. Similarly, Democrats argued that the readjusters had used the spoils network for political gain to the detriment of Virginia's civil service system. These charges in particular have been controversial between historians. Some have argued that both charges are accurate, while others offer a more qualified approach. The best argument comes from Dr. Moore, who argues that both charges are unfounded. For the first, he argues that much of the evidence against Mahone is based entirely on the time period of his rule, rather than on his actions, and he points to Mahone's pragmatic way of negotiating compromises, in contrast to other political bosses who relied on dogmatic, dictatorial demands. For the second charge, Dr. Moore admits that there is no way to defend the spoils system as anything but corrupt, but instead defends the party by arguing that this corruption was at worst a net neutral. As I previously mentioned, the spoils system was nothing new, and it was customary for both political parties. Dr. Moore then argues that men who were given these positions were generally well qualified and actually helped to improve Virginia's civil services rather than acting to their detriment. One particular example was the readjuster Board of Visitors at the University of Virginia, who took over in 1881 over much protest and uneasiness by both the student body and the faculty. Much to their collective relief, the readjuster board ran the school more efficiently and with less regard to professors' political leanings than their funder predecessors had. The final two arguments Democrat made against the readjusters was that debt repudiation had hurt white supremacy and that Mahone had tried to republicanize Virginia. Historians generally agree with both of those statements, although some take qualms with the idea that Mahone tried to do anything less than create his own independent political party. Regardless, it is true that the need for debt repudiation created opportunities for greater civil rights reform, pushed through by African American demands, and that Mahone sided with the Republican Party to create a workable, sustainable coalition in Virginia. Most historians agree that, for the most part, these arguments were persuasive in turning Virginia against the debt revolt. But two other explanations have also been offered that shift the responsibility from the Democrat Party elites. The first of these two is that the coalition was only ever really intended to repudiate the debt, and after that was completed, there was little reason for white members of the coalition to continue to vote for a party with significant black representation. Mahone's charisma and the spoil system was therefore always doomed to fail under this interpretation, because the men who had signed up for the Register Party were not primarily concerned with the creation of a biracial independent political party. A second interpretation looks at the broader racial animosities and social unrest in Virginia in the early 1880s. It looks at the debt crisis similar to how funders saw it, as a question of honor. After the Civil War, much of the social structure in Virginia had been deteriorated, and questions of how honor and dignity would be displayed in the new order were on display in the debt crisis. The primary evidence of this social unrest comes from the rapid increase in duels in Virginia during the readjuster movement. This comes at a time when duels were in a rapid decline everywhere else in the nation. The second piece of evidence for this interpretation is the Danville Riot, or sidewalk etiquette centered around freed people not showing the white townspeople the quote-unquote proper honor and respect, caused full-blown terror. The mass turn against the readjusters, then, can be understood as the masses determining that the biracial coalition was a threat to the honor of Virginia, since the upstart biracial coalition had supposedly caused both the dishonor of repudiation and now the dishonor of social equality with freed people. It isn't likely that any evidence will surface that conclusively proves any of these interpretations, and it is likely that all these interpretations have some of the truth in it, and it just really depended on each individual voter. If anyone would like to do additional readings or research into this topic, I provided a link to my website in the show's description that has several of the most popular titles and sources that I used for this podcast. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you next time on the 10-Minute U.S. History Podcast.